have taken place for members of the executive committee of the Socialist Party and international delegates. And the left wing has a big majority. Even Helquist, who was, and Berger, who was the candidates for international delegates, are both defeated. Mm-hmm. And these are the real strong powers in the SP. That showed you how the left wing had made big inroads by that time.
Was the left wing self-conscious then? Did they perceive themselves as a different
certain elements were, but not all. But the left wing became strong, you know, after the Bolshevik Revolution, because we had all these ethnic groups, all the Slavic people, you know, Russians, Ukrainians, Lithuanians, Latvians, they all streamed into the Socialist Party, to the federations. The Socialist Party grew to 118,000 members at the time of the convention in September.
Was that mostly was it mostly foreign-born people then in the Socialist Party?
The majority of the members. Now, I wouldn't call them advanced consciously, no, but these were in favor of the revolution, emotionally anyway, and joined the Socialist Party, and supported the left wing, you knew enough to do that. So the national leadership declared these elections null and void, and expelled the Slavic Federation. So when I came to Chicago, we were already expelled. I reported at Socialist Party headquarters. I was given a car with my name, a white car. There were four delegates from Seattle. We all got white cars. And it didn't take very long before we discovered some delegates got red cars. All those that they knew were left wingers, they would in advance give them white cars because only red cars were admitted to the convention.
Oh.
Convention hall, you know. The convention took place in the Machinist local headquarters. Machinist local 113. We had their own building. Big auditorium on the second floor. We were shut off from the convention. And little by little, become quite a bunch of us, all with just white cars. We organized a flying wedge, put Hitler up in front. He was a big, heavy man. John Reed next to him. John Reed was pretty good size, too, and a good scrap. And then this wedge, you know, made its way into the convention. It took all seats. To be expelled by the Chicago police, acting on behest of the officials. Then that we didn't resist. No, they had enough sense not to do that. And better strategy not to. So we right away gathered on the first floor in the smaller hall.
How many people were there?
I couldn't give you the number right now. I'll give you the number. The next day, I'll be.
Okay.
We gathered there. Well, there were 70 or 80 of their votes, something like that. And I had to remember the Slavic Federations were expelled. We were not there at all. We, by the way, held their convention at the same time in another area of Chicago. There were two Communist parties formed, not one. But anyway, we gathered in that hall below, and then we began to sort of consider programs and questions of that kind. Every now and then, you know, three cheers would ring out. Three cheers for the Bolsheviks. Three cheers for Eugene Debs, which is present. Three cheers for the IWW. And he would shout, you know, and that could be heard of in the auditorium above where the elders were meeting. And of course, present certain forebodings to them.
Can I ask you two quick questions about that?
No, well, let me add one point then, first. The first point was some delegates who had not come with us still remained upstairs but sent word to us. What did we think we should do? So we decided the next day, that means the second day, the opening of the convention, the first motion should be introduced that all those delegates who had been unseated be entitled to take their seats. And that brought another 47 delegates, because I was turned down, that brought another 47 delegates to us. And by that time we had about 120. Representing pretty well the different states. Pretty well, sir. That is wherever the Socialist Party was organized. No, what was your question?
Well, the two things I want to know is first, when the left wing was expelled and you went down to the first floor, the people already people immediately assumed that they were going to organize another party.
That's right.
There was no question about
no
that.
No question.
Uh-huh.
The left, during the process of the development of the left wing, we had already become convinced of that.
Oh, that you were going to have
a different kind of parties needed. A revolutionary party. And a party that affiliates itself with the Bolshevik Revolution. And with the Common Term. Common Term was organized in 1992.
Mm-hmm. And what was Debs' position during this whole thing?
You know, Debs had played an honorable role through the whole history of the Socialist Party as their foremost spokesman. Class war prisoners. Every time he went to Yale, you know, he would always make a ring speech that was sort of a reverberate throughout the whole party and sympathizing ranks too. He made a declaration after the Bolshevik Revolution, from the crown of my head to the soles of my feet, I am a Bolshevik and proud of it. Just the same, when the actual break came, that was then in Yale. And when he was released only under President Harding. President Harding released, pardon me. And he followed Wilson. And that was after the war. Yeah, that was a good deal after the war was over. 1921, I believe, or 22. 21, Harding. Wilson. No, 21 would not be the next year. Must have been 22. 20 or 20. Well, anyway, it was very early 20s when Harding became president, he pardoned Debs. Now, there's one peculiarity about Debs. While he was this tremendously effective spokesman for socialism, he never took part in the internal life of the party. The leadership were in the hands of a bunch of lawyers, mostly doctors, what have you, like Maurice Lequit or Victor Berger in Milwaukee, this type, Algernon Lee, James O'Neill, all of them, you know, not worker types, but politicians, middle class type, many of them in fact. Debs would never take part in that. In that internal struggle. Debs actually agreed that it was possible to have an all-inclusive party. That left wing and right wing could both be in the same party and could cooperate. And we did for a period of time. Yeah. We did up until the split took place in 1919. Yeah. So he did not come along. He was released from prison after the new party had already began functioning, and he remained at ASP, although he never really took any prominent part after that.
Right. Okay, did you all step back to the strike for
Oh, okay. I mean, I'm not a heavy smoker, but you sure didn't talk a lot if she needed.
Tell me if I'm...
You smoke?
No, thank you. Tell me if I'm taking too much time. Do you remember the Army coming in during the strike?
During what?
The Army coming in, or the National Guard, or anything like that?
Camp Lewis was the Army training camp. By the way, I spent less than 45 days in Camp Lewis. I was taken into the American Army.
Hmm.
Well, I was taken into the Army as a slacker, as a matter of fact. In Wyoming, I went for examination. I was not a citizen. It couldn't be. You had to live there 5 years before you could become a citizen. So I protested that I was not eligible for service. I had to be accepted because of being a Danish citizen. Well, it didn't mean anything. I was already called after we had left Casper, Wyoming, when we were traveling up in first in Yellowstone Park and then the actual Glacier National Park. Then when I landed in Seattle, I went to the room. And the second day, a couple of pictures were there. Because I had been called, and I was in a sitter, that I didn't know what I had been called. But the minute you put it to me, then I, of course, then knew what was up. Well, they just put me in jail, and then out to Fort Lawton, and there I was inducted into the Army. But I went out to Camp Lewis, and I was just on the eve of the Army. November 11th. I think I was inducted a couple of days before actually inducted. But I got an honorable discharge. Although it says AWOL for that period when I was called and didn't show up.
So you only in 45 days and then?
Less than 45 days, not entitled to any pension.
And but they didn't. Were you then discharged because the war was over and they had no more need, or was it because you were left wing or discharged?
Well, look, I was anti-military in any case in that 1 year. And the minute I got out of the Army and I had an honorable discharge, well, I went back to Seattle and back to my work and my regular activity.
Mm-hmm.
The flag was over. Shooting me right when the war came to an end.
Uh-huh.
I would have hated to have to go to Europe.
Did you eat in any of the strikers' dining halls during the strike?
Hmm?
Did you eat in any of the dining halls that were during the strike?
Yeah.
You remember those pretty well.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Food prepared by cooks who knew how to prepare food.
That
good nourishing food. Not elaborate.
But it worked pretty smoothly.
Oh, everything went very smoothly. I remember we had an enormous hall with all the disposal for the feeding strikers. But I went for my feeding. We had a number of feeding stations set up. Quite a number. Not up in the rich areas, naturally. We let them take care of themselves. Yeah. You asked the Army. An Army regiment was.
Oh, okay.
But the officers had enough sense to keep them discreetly in the background.
So they,
so they never really became conspicuous in the end. But we knew they were there.
Did that affect the strike in any way?
No.
They were there?
The strike went into regular course. No, we had the ones we had to confront more directly than police. And Ole Hansen had deputized the 600 additional police that's what we had to contend with. And we also knew that we got to try not to give any excuse for politics, for police intervention. That we knew. And we tried to avoid that. And the police, organized by the General Strike Committee, saw to that. That was their duty, to make sure that there were no demonstrations of the kind that the police could use as an excuse.
Was the General Strike worth it for labor?
Was it what?
Was it worth it?
Was it worth it? I told you, it didn't attain the objective for the strike. It should not worth it. In fact, their strike was really sold out in the end by their own international officials. But at the same time also, the shipyards, the shipbuilding industry was being dismantled at the same time. It had a tremendous spiritual effect.
A positive effect.
Very positive, in Seattle and throughout the country.
Then, did you feel that at the end of the strike, most workers felt proud of the General Strike, or did they feel it had been a failure?
All felt proud of it. I remember here in L.A. once, Nam, you know about Nam? By the way, I'm a member of Nam.
I have some greetings from other Nam comrades. I'll tell you later.
Then you've got a good man with chapter up in Santa Barbara. Very good one. I saw one of their documents. Good. I was asked to speak at one of their forums when he started doing a strike. I did. And there were some ultra-leftists there also. One is knew just exactly. Well, during the 5 days, how much did the worker consciousness advance? Well, I had to tell them. You know it doesn't advance that fast. But it really became manifest in the conduct of the strike and also in what it meant to the workers after the strike and the effect throughout the country.
So you felt that the General Strike did affect working people all over the country?
Was fully worldwide. Fully worldwide.
I know that it was a large issue in the Chicago Communist Trial, Communist Labor Party, that Clarence Darrow defended a year or two later.
Well, that was after Palmer Race. The Palmer Race came
right.
January 1920. But it rounded up all the aliens he could get hold of and deported a whole shipload of them. I was in Seattle. A strong labor movement. Palmer Race never got into Seattle. Never.
That's very interesting.
And that speaks also well for the movement there. That's the reason he never wasn't in there. Otherwise, that would probably have been picked up tonight.
How about, though, that's interesting, federal government. Wasn't there, late 1919, there were a couple of prizes, weren't there? I mean, there was the attacks on the Socialist Party headquarters and on the Wobbly headquarters and the shutting down of the Union Records for a couple
of days. Both away, the Socialist Party headquarters and IWW. And that was the time when the IWW got invited involved to trial.
Mm-hmm. Was that a result of the General Strike that they started those raids?
Oh,
and also
but it happened after the strike had come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
They were for blood, you know. Leading bourgeois, the ruling bourgeois, you know, for blood. He wanted some victims that he could really punish. He got nowhere.
Did the General Strike affect your life?
Yes.
I mean, did it, not just for those days, but did it have an effect on your life afterwards?
In the sense that a tremendous lesson I learned, for one thing. For one thing. And then also, in a sense, you know, that I became a member, founder of the Communist Party, something entirely new.
Could you tell me a little bit more about both of those? You said you learned a great lesson. I'd like to hear a little more about that. And also, what's the connection between your between the general strike and your becoming one of the founders of the Communist Party?
Well, becoming one of the founders, that was because I was a member of the left wing. And the split took place in Seattle. We did not engineer the left wing. The right wing did. In fact, we were expelled by the police.
Mm-hmm. Was there a connection between that, though, and the general strike in Seattle?
In the sense, as far as we from four delegates from Seattle were definitely demarked. And also, in a sense, you know that it had intensified the struggle in the Socialist Party.
The general strike had?
Oh, yes. It had an effect on that.
Could you tell me a little bit more about that, and what way that...
Well, in a sense, you know that how it stimulated the left wing. Two great stimulants. More, the greatest, of course, the Bolshevik Revolution, 1917. But also the general strike in Seattle.
Also, you would rank it as the
stimulated the left wing and the goals of the left wing and the consciousness of the left wing.
Do you think then that it was the second leading event in the United next to the Russian Revolution?
I would say that, yes. At that time it was. At that time it was. Because it is recognized even today as the first really officially recognized general strike on the American continent, although during the upheavals of the 80s there had been citywide strikes. One time workers took over in St. Louis and won the city for a brief time. But the Seattle General Strike is recognized in history as the first, what is maybe called bona fide general strike. That is really conducted by the labor movement, which was then the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else but the Air Force.
Did people in the left wing think that there was much greater hope that was that used by people in the left wing and the Socialist Party to say, look, workers are on the move and we should be moving much farther?
That's exactly what it did. Yeah. It helped to stimulate the idea for a new party, a party that was a revolutionary party, that really corresponded to the needs of the working class at the time.
Yeah. You also said that it affected your life and that you learned a great lesson.
Yeah, and it also affected my life insofar as my actual function, activity was concerned. You know, during that period, I was still a member of the Scandinavian Federation, that part of the Socialist Party. And the Scandinavian Federation published a paper, and they published two papers in Chicago, one in Swedish, one in Danish and Norwegian. And I had contributed stories about general strike and about developments in Seattle and that whole northwest area. So I was asked to come to return to Chicago and become editor of the paper.
And as a result of those stories?
Yeah. As a result of my activity there and what I had written into the paper and so forth.
So did you do that then?
1920. I returned to Chicago. Became editor. Then I was already a member of the Communist Party. After the Palmer Raids. It didn't take very long before I recognized and other comrades with me there in the Scandinavian Federation that a language, foreign language paper had really outlived its function because the Scandinavians were more quickly assimilated in the general American population and the working class more quickly than, for example, in the Slavic Federation, that took more slowly. The Scandinavians adapt themselves more easily, more quickly to them. So it was only, I was editor of that paper only for some weeks. Then they decided to transfer it into an English speaking paper. The call of New World Well, Catholic also contested the need. Of course, he had that need for that. So all that, he said, we need. And that became then transformed shortly after to the Voice of Labor, which was the unofficial spokesman for the underground Communist Party. The Communist Party was driven underground by the Palmer race. We had to function underground until the end of 1921, when we could finally organize the Workers' Party to come up and function legally. So, of course, when that Scandinavian paper, The New Age, was turned over to the Voice of Labor, well, my job ceased, although I collaborated, but my English was more deficient then than it is now, naturally. So I got a new job. I was made the district organizer of the second largest district in the country, Chicago. I took in the whole state of Illinois, the whole state, and the Calumet region of Indiana, the steel region, and the lower part of Wisconsin. Second most important district in the country.
To New York? Second to New York?
New York was the largest. So I was made district organizer. I told the party that I had not had that experience. Well, they all said, what experience have we had? Same thing. We all had to learn by duty. And I remained at that post up until the Lovestone Group finally took over the Communist Party completely.
That's a long time.
1927. And I was kicked out. But even then, after that, there was also the, I think that's also the general part of the effect of my work and activity and experience in Seattle. Mm-hmm. One of the big kingpins of the Communist Party leadership was a foreigner, John Pepper, who had, he had been one of the social democratic group in Hungary who split away and united with the Béla Kun Communist Party in setting up the Soviet government in 1919. And it didn't last very long, it was overthrown. And then these leading elements fled to Moscow. And there they were, a group of immigrants, you know, in Moscow. The pre-Hungarian Revolution. Didn't take very long before intense factional fights erupted in that small group, which is usually the case when you're kicked off of power and then have to exist in a different country. So the Communist International, to sort of try to break that up, decided to send Pepper to the United States. His name was Pogani. He came to the United States to work in the Hungarian Bureau. But you know, he was long training and much more experienced than we were through the fights in Europe, both externally and internally, factionally, what have you. And it didn't take very long before he was a spokesman in English. And he became elected a member of the Central Committee at the Underground Convention in Michigan, in Bridgman, in the woods of Michigan. I was not there. I was then already in Moscow. That's how I escaped that. Otherwise, that probably would have been picked up too. So I had a lot of luck in my life. Lots of luck. But I remained that post till 1927. 1925, I became a member of the Central Committee, the Communist Party.
How large was the Central Committee at that time?
Quite large. I don't know if I can give you an exact number.
Oh, not an exact number.
More than 20.
Uh-huh. how often does the Central Committee get together to...
It will get together only, with intervals of a month or so. But it elected a political bureau, a political committee, that was then in charge in between. The Central Committee will meet in plenums, off and on. So let's say every other, every third month, something like that, depending on what the questions were or what issues were, had to be tackled. But then I was going to mention further changes of my life. Pepper finally, we overcome the Pepper leadership in 1923. The Foster Cannon group, the major group, the Wilsonburg, the Pepper Lovestone group, were a minority. Pepper was recalled to Moscow on our insistence. And in Moscow, he was assigned to go to Korea, which was then considered a graveyard for communist representatives. He never went to Korea. He came back to the United States instead. But he was a fugitive, that is, from the Communist International. But he had no sooner landed here than he proclaimed himself he was not going to be a faction fighter, nor he was going to be a moderator between the two factions. And he asked it's the wish of the party leadership that you continue working for the party. I'm going back to work at my place, or try to anyway. So I said, well, I prefer that. I like to work for the party. Foster was away at the Sixth Congress at the time, 1928. And the Sixth Congress lasted several months. That's for Stalin finally to over complete power in the leadership. Besides, Foster was the candidate for president on the CP ticket. And when he returned, he would have to make a tour of the country. And we had the Communist Party had a big movement going in the coal miners' union. We called it the Save the Union Movement, against the Lewis regime, John A. Lewis, he was a real bureaucrat in those days, real bureaucrat. He expelled left-wingers wherever he had a chance. But we hadn't managed to start a big movement, Save the Union movement. So I was to take Foster's place in his absence as the director of the party factions in this movement. But there was no particular distinction between the Communist Party members and the general left-wing members. They all accepted me. I was accepted by the whole movement. So I was active in that for about 6 months, I guess. And that finally wound up in organizing a new union. The first of the new unions organized by the Communist Party.
What was that?
The National Miners Union. But it had really come to a point where we had no other way out. We had the left wing to save the union movement. We had called for a convention in Pittsburgh. That was the end of 1928. And we had difficulty getting a hall because city authorities didn't want to Christmas interest. When we finally got the Jewish headquarters up on the hill in Pittsburgh, we went to the hall tours. And we knew that Lewis was organizing a gang to storm the hall, and several miners who had been made delegates to that gathering had already been assassinated. So we sent a big contingent of our delegates up to take possession of the hall the evening before the convention, or the day before the convention. And a gang of Lewis supporters, about 400 of them, stormed the hall. But he got the worst of it, because he had a good contingent inside. He broke up chairs to fight with. But then the police came, of course. And as always, the police never lines up on the side of the left. Never. We were the Lewis forces, but we finally closed the hall. We couldn't even hold the convention there. So we had to go to the Hungarian workers' home in East Pittsburgh. It was very much reduced forces. We had about 125 in jail. We had several in the hospital. And some were killed too. So we had very much reduced forces. But what could we do? There was no more chance for the left wing to save the miners' union. That was entirely out. We had no way out for the organizing union. And that's what we decided right then and there to do. And the party approved of it. But then also, that happened to coincide with the, what we call the third period of the Communist International. Then Stalin, you know, where he had complete control, he began to take over some of Trotsky's ideas of making the whole movement more revolutionary. And that meant in the United States, that meant for the Communist Party to organize new unions wherever they had just a mere toehold, and organized quite a whole series of new unions that never got to touch things. And of course, objective conditions are not yet ready for a breakthrough day of the world. That only came in the 1930s. That's since we were ahead of our time. But as far as the miners' union was concerned, we had no other way out. Either the movement would have collapsed and disintegrated in defeat, or else the new union. Well, the new union didn't ever become very successful, but at any rate, they held the left-wing forces together. So they still remained together when we came to the 30th, the BCIO together. So in that sense, we were correct. But then, you know, it was 1928, I was expelled from the Communist Party because we decided to cross here against Stalin.
And then you became a founder of the Socialist Workers' Party, is that right?
The Trotskyist movement, yeah. Socialist Workers. It was not the call of the Socialist Workers' Party yet. That came only in 1938, the Trotskyist movement. We organized the Communist League of America.
Right.
And on the basis, you know, we proclaimed ourselves communists, and that we had been unjustly expelled, wanted to make our way back to the Communist Party and reform the Communist Party, that is, make it more left, more militant, more radical, revolutionary. Of course, we never succeeded, we never returned either. And during that period, well, we also had our internal troubles. No, because we were a small group to begin with. And a small group always has difficulty existing, particularly in a big party like the Communist Party. They are blocking the way everywhere, and including open physical attacks upon us. We had to organize our own forces to defend our meetings everywhere. And only then, instilled respect, then we stopped it. The everyone. He said, I remember, we had our meeting on the second floor. Our guard literally threw the CP members down the stairs. Literally threw them down. That's all he could do. Had to act that fast. Matter of life and death. So that also became the reason why it was agreed that I should go on this across in 1933. And I also attend an international conference on the way in Paris. Which I did, of course. Hitler had taken power in Germany. We had a sort of an international secretariat set up in Germany. And the head man, the secretary, detected to the CP. Later I learned he was actually doing a plan by the Stalin secret police, but I learned only later. He detected. And then the Hitler in power, well, we recognized that we had to move the headquarters to Paris. That was the main problem at that conference. There were some delegates from Germany attending the conference, but they were only the Germans who already had fled Germany. They were in emigration in Paris, France. So it was decided on their way, I to go and see Trotsky. I should make my way over Berlin and contact the Trotsky's there and give them the report of the conference. At the same time, I was also to meet Trotsky's son there, Yova, who wanted me to bring a radio along to Klinkenburg for Trotsky, because radios were impossible to buy a radio in Turkey. The import duties are so enormous, and just no chance of investing that big money. So I saw Hitler under Germany, Germany under Hitler. I was well acquainted in Berlin from my younger days, you know. I'll tell you one incident particularly. I knew from the past, you know, I always liked the Berliners, the jolly Berliners. I liked them. But there was an entirely different kind of Berliners I saw now when I came there. And I knew from my young days there that the daily papers were usually posted in glass cases on important street corners that people could gather and read. You had no privately owned daily papers in Germany. All published by political groups, either right wing or left wing, social democrats, communists, what have you. So the first morning after I had landed in Berlin, I went down and knew there was an important street corner there. I wanted to see what the press had to say. See the papers. And there were quite a gathering there, reading the paper. And we heard a noise in the distance, almost like a thunder, far away, kind of rumbling noise, seeming to become more and more audible. It didn't take very long before the whole gathering scattered, disappeared. But I could see in their eyes, they knew what it meant. I didn't know yet. Therefore now, a whole long line of trucks came with Hitler stormtroopers shouting, "Heil Hitler." That was the noise. All the trucks were loaded with Nazis to terrorize the people. At other times the noise may be drums that you heard in the distance, on military bands, also leading the Nazi stormtroopers, everywhere in order to terrorize the people. I haven't been in Berlin long enough to see the attack on the communist headquarters. They called Liebknecht House. Then I said, I left a few months ago. I have become acquainted with all the, I contacted the Postmaster there all right there. He had all codes how to do it, and I knew it. Made contact with all the aid that occurred. Of course, he was on the ground that day. I made also acquaintance with a charming young couple. He was an engineer at a big Siemens sugar establishment, and he had picked the radio, which was the most advanced at the time, that he also had a loudspeaker, but a big contraption. Not like now, built in. Big contraption. And both he and his wife said, now when you return, if you come over Berlin, by all means visit us. And I said, I wouldn't, I wanted to. But this big radio, we had to go and talk to son, I had to go and shop and find a sort of small size trunk to put it in. And of course, I could not fit there alone with my baggage on the plane. Well, the conductor just wouldn't listen to me. No, nothing doing. I had to go in the baggage train. And there's a question as to whether I didn't break it through. And I didn't. It wound up in the hands of some Turkish custom officials. No, this wouldn't let pass. No chance. So that mission I couldn't carry out.
What was Trotsky like? What was Trotsky like as a person to work with?
No, I had met Trotsky before. At the Fourth Congress, both Lenin and Trotsky spoke, and he were the main members, and recognized us. And in fact, Lenin at the time was supposed to give the main report at the Fourth Congress. And he said, because of my recent illness, I cannot be. He had had a stroke 7 months before. I would take only one part of my subject. The new economic policy in Russia. But he said, I asked this Congress to urge Comrade Trotsky. No, put it differently. I urged this Congress to ask Comrade Trotsky to make the main report. He did it kind of demonstratively.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why he did it so demonstratively, that I realized only later. Because Lenin was already in the past of Stalin, of his bureaucracy. So I had met him there, Trotsky spoke, he made the main report. And he really impressed us, you know, as a leader in full command, like Lenin, also. Radiating power, you know, a certain sense of power. Even though Lenin had a stroke before, some delegates said, you succeeded before the stroke. It was even more so. But both of them did, stood out there as a powerful leader. Who knew what the perspectives were, what the direction was, and what was needed, and what to say. Well, I found Trotsky the same in principle, although he was split of all powers. Well, I found him still a great leader. But when he, by that time, he had already gone through these major battles with the Soviet Party. Now he was entirely on the international arena. And it was at that visit that Trotsky also proposed that we should no longer follow the old policy of attempting to return to the Communist Party. After the German defeat, the Communist Party, all its actions and tactics as far as completely endorsed by the Communist International. And the come this far, did not fight. Did not. Hitler came into power just too goddamn easily. Just too damn easily. Because the Communist Party had the policy that the Social Democrats are the main enemy, social fascists, as they call it. And they directed all that fire against the Social Democrats. Meanwhile, Hitler forces grew and grew rapidly. The stormtroopers grew 400,000 by the time it took power. 400,000. And he even participated in the election. 8 million votes, more than the Communist Party. From 800,000 to the previous election, to 8 million. So, Trotsky then proposed to completely reorient, build new parties and new international. Well, we knew our forces were small. We agreed to like the only way out. Now the message I brought back from my visit and that agreement in the United States. And here we were fortunately able to unite with the Muslim group. Of course, that didn't really last because then we entered the Socialist Party. That I'm convinced now was a mistake. But I was for them. And I'm convinced now that was a mistake. The whole CIO movement practically attacked us by. And we had a good chance to be an important factor in it because of our leadership of the strikes in Minneapolis. And the Muskiites had leadership in the strike in Toledo. It was a good chance to be on the ground floor. But as they watched, you know, the Communist Party then complete leadership politically, although Louis was the leader, without a question of doubt. And Louis had also made a turn from his former position. He had also learned a lesson. Miners were reduced to 65,000 members from 400,000 and 450,000 at the peak. But I also suffered depression combined with depression was an additional factor.
Let me go back to the strike, ask you a few more questions about that in the time around us. First, something was you said you learned a great lesson from the strike. What was that great lesson?
Well, in several areas. First of all, you know, I was relatively new to any conditions in the United States. I was not a well-trained veteran by any means. Youngster. I came here in 1916, despite the place in 1919. First of all, in the sense that I really found out what a labor movement is when it's up on all its toes. That had a tremendous impact on my thinking, influenced on my thinking, reshaped my thinking, you know, what a labor movement is and what it can be. And especially when you have the proper forces to help the process. Now, a revolutionary group cannot by itself create a revolutionary situation or manufacture a revolution. But if you have a revolutionary group that is in accord with the process of development of objective conditions, then it really begins to mean something. And I happen to become a part of that grouping, although it was not yet really a fully organized caucus. It's kind of a loose grouping. You sort of come together, you know. Now and then, always after every Central Labor Council meeting, always, you never fail that, to kind of sum up, you know, what did it mean, what happened. That's a great help to me, you know. Because there were some old timers there, also, going through a lot of battles. that I had not issued my cross warning. And then also in another sense, in a sort of an opposite way, very many of my good, wobbly fellow workers were deadly against the idea of terminating the strike. They wanted to go on. Well, there I learned one had to draw the line, unless you wait to struggle for power. Now the IWWB started out as a militant organization talking for an entirely new social order. One thing we never did learn, that means you got to take power of the political state. We never did learn that. Never really understood or understand that. But that's really what it meant in Seattle if you're going to continue that even. You either have to take power or you have to end it, one or the other. There is no middle way. Mm-hmm. And I had to have a good many arguments with my good fellow workers on that score.
How did you
but that was kind of a thing that I learned in the process. I was not fully conscious of that before the war, because I was not a developed socialist, a well-developed socialist by any means.
How did the strike affect the life of the city?
In the city?
Yeah. I don't mean during the strike, but what was the long-term effect? Did it have a long-term effect on the city?
Yes, a long-term effect in this sense that the Seattle labor movement, even though the shipyards were closed down, still remained a good left outpost.
You feel that was probably a result of the strike?
Also the Russian Revolution, of course, the Wall Street Revolution. But the strike played its part, too. Mm-hmm. Played an important part. You know, there's no greater lesson for people than the actual experience of going through themselves in practice. Mm-hmm. You can learn a lot from books, but practice is an important aspect, too.
There were a couple of people I wanted to ask you about, most of them you said something about, but you haven't mentioned Anna Louise Strong. Do you have any memories of her?
She was Ault was the editor of the group. Anna Louise Strong was in charge of the editorial page. And she wrote every day her ragged verse, improvised poetry. But we always had a social content. And they were trying to always get home. Written in language that every worker could understand. So she played a great role in, she was a confirmed socialist at the time. She had helped found the Seattle Daily Socialist before the strike. And during the period of the war hysteria, a bunch of sailors were instigated by right-wing forces to smash up the plant that the paper was printing. That was the end of it.
Mm.
But she was already a confirmed socialist at the time. Now, I met her just a couple of times, sort of more or less casually. Still, it's a couple of remarks. It was just casual at that time. But I became very acquainted with her later on. At one time, you know, when was that about? Well, it was when the fight between Stalin and Trotsky was going on full force in the Soviet Union, she returned to the United States for visit. She was commissioned by the New York Times magazine to write an article about the conflict between Stalin and Trotsky. That's how it was put, you know. It was not just two men. They both had their forces. There were big numbers involved in on both sides, or Stalin had the So when she was commissioned to write that article, she got in touch with the party central committee. She said she should not do that on her own. And she asked the party central committee to select one of its members to work with her. I was selected for the job. So I became well acquainted with her.
Was that because of your Trotskyist leanings that they selected you?
No, I think that was just so happy that he selected me. For one thing, you know, I had always been very interested in international affairs. And I have been one of the spearheads in support, in the left wing in support of the Bolshevik Revolution. Mm-hmm. So that was known.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess from that point of view, so well, I did not have Trotskyist leanings yet at that time, because we never really knew what Trotsky stood for until we actually had been expelled and got Trotsky's works. You know, during that whole dispute, whatever Trotsky stood for would come only little bits here and there that never made a consistent picture. Stalin's position, long speeches and what have you, documents, long. So we were not Trotskyists by the time we really came up to the question of expulsion. We were only after Cameron got hold of Trotsky's criticism of the black program of the Comintern at the Sixth Comintern Congress in 1928. Only when we read that, after first we got of Trotsky's actual position. But at that time, you know, anyway, I was selected as the one to work with her. Now, she right away explained to me, she did not feel fully competent to go into the whole theoretical aspects of the dispute. Socialism in one country, what does it mean, permanent revolution, what have you. So she said, if I go into that, I may make mistakes, and I don't want to do that. She says, I would rather present the conflict in a sense of the people and what they were, what they came from. On the one side, you had Trotsky, who had been in exile in years, with Lenin and other elements that she didn't mention. They were internationalists primarily, and they saw primarily the international aspect of the revolution. On the other hand was Stalin, who had barely been outside of Russia. He was once outside, but barely of it. But he was solidly rooted in the Russian soil and in the apparatus of the Communist Party. That was his strong point. The internationalist was the strong point of the other side. And Stalin's strong point proved to be victorious. Well, I knew nothing more about him than she did. And I said, well, that's for sure. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead. And I reported that to the Central Committee. She wrote me later. Of course, I met her also at the Fourth Congress in Moscow in 1922. And became quite well acquainted with her there, because a national referendum had taken place for members of the executive committee of the Socialist Party and international delegates. And the left wing shares with a big majority. Even Hillquist, who was, and Berger, who was the candidates for international delegates, are both defeated.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the real strong power in the SP. That shows you. So the left wing had made big inroads by that time.
Was the left wing self-conscious then? Did they perceive themselves as a different part of the
elements, party? Certain elements were, but not all. But the left wing became strong, you know, after the Bolshevik Revolution, because we had all these ethnic groups, all the Slavic people, you know, Russians, Ukrainians, Lithuanians, Latvians, they all streamed into the Socialist Party, to the Federation. The Socialist Party grew to 118,000 members at the time of the convention in September.
Was that mostly was it mostly foreign-born people then in the Socialist Party?
The majority of the members. Now, I wouldn't call them advanced consciously, no, but they were in favor of the revolution, emotionally anyway, and joined the Socialist Party, and supported the left wing, they knew enough to do that. So the national leadership declared these elections null and void, and expelled the Slavic Federation. So when I came to Chicago, it was already expelled. I reported at Socialist Party headquarters. I was given a car with my name, a white car. There were four delegates from Seattle. We all got white cars. And didn't take very long before we discovered some delegates got red cars. All those that they knew were left wingers, they would in advance give them white cars because only red cars were admitted to the convention.
Oh.
Convention hall, you know. The convention took place in the Machinist local headquarters. Machinist local 113. We had their own building. Big auditorium on the second floor. We were shut off from the convention. And little by little, we were quite a bunch of us. All the just white cars. We organized a flying wedge. Put Hitler up in front. He was a big, heavy man. John Reed next to him. John Reed was pretty good size, too, and a good scrap. And then this wedge, you know, made its way into the convention. It took all seats. To be expelled by the Chicago police. Acting on behest of the officials. Then that we didn't resist. No, they had enough sense not to do that. And better strategy not to. So we, right away, gathered on the first floor in the smaller hall.
How many people were there?
I couldn't give you the number right now. I'll give you the number.
The next day,
we gathered there. Well, there were 70 or 80 of their boats, something like that. And I had to remember the Slavic Federations were expelled. We were not there at all. We, by the way, held their convention at the same time in another area of Chicago. There were two Communist parties formed, not one. But anyway, we got on that hall below, and then we began to sort of consider programs and questions of that kind. Every now and then, you know, three cheers would ring out. Three cheers for the Bolsheviks. Three cheers for Eugene Debs. Question. Three cheers for the IWW, and he would shout, you know, and that could be heard up in the auditorium above where the elders were meeting, and of course present something for votings to them.
Can I ask you two quick questions about that?
No, well, let me add one point then, sir. The first point, what some delegates who had not come with us still remained upstairs, but sent word to us. What did we think we should do? So we decided the next day, that means the second day, the opening of the convention, the first motion should be introduced that all those delegates who had been unseated be entitled to take their seats. And that brought another 47 delegates. Because I was turned down. That brought another 47 delegates to us. And by that time, we had about 120.
Yeah.
Just one by one, 120. Representing pretty well in different states. Pretty well. That is wherever the Socialist Party was organized. No, what was your question?
Well, the two things I want to know is first, when the left wing was expelled and you went down to the first floor, the people already was, it sounds as if people immediately assumed that they were going to organize another party.
That's right.
There was no question about
no
it.
No question.
Uh-huh.
They left, during the process of the development of the left wing, we had already become convinced of that.
Oh, that you were
a new and a different kind of party is needed, a revolutionary party, and a party that affiliates itself with the Bolshevik Revolution and with the Comintern. Comintern was organized in 1992.
Mm-hmm. And what was Debs' position during this whole thing?
You know, Debs had played an honorable role through the whole history of the Socialist Party as their foremost spokesman. Class war prisoners. Every time he went to jail, you know, he would always make a ring speech that was sort of a reverberate throughout the whole party and sympathizing ranks too. He made a declaration after the Bolshevik Revolution, from the crown of my head to the soles of my feet, I am a Bolshevik and proud of it. Just the same, when the actual break came, that was then in jail. And when he was released only under President Harding. President Harding released Harding. And he followed Wilson. And that was after the war, yeah, that's a good deal after the war was over. Mm-hmm. 1921, I believe, or 22. 21, hardly. Well, some, no, 21 would not be an election year. Must have been 22. 20 or 20. Well, anyway, it was very early 20s. When Harding became president, he pardoned the Debs. Now, there's one peculiarity about Debs. While he was this tremendously effective spokesman for socialism, he never took part in the internal life of the party. The leadership were in the hands of a bunch of lawyers, mostly doctors, and what have you, like Maurice Wilkins or Victor Berger in Milwaukee, this type. Algin O'Neill, James O'Neill, all of them, you know, not worker types, but politicians, middle-class type, many of them, in fact. Debs would never take part in that internal struggle. Debs actually agreed that it was possible to have an all-inclusive party, that left-wing and right-wing could both be in the same party, and could cooperate. And we did for a period of time. Yeah. We did up until the split took place in 1919. Yeah. So he did not come along. He was released from prison after the new party had already began functioning. And he remained at ASP. Although he never really took any prominent part after that.
Okay, did y'all
get
back to the strike for...
Okay. Let me... I'm not a heavy smoker, but you should talk a lot, it seems to me.
Tell me if I'm...
You smoke?
No, thank you. Tell me if I'm... taking too much time. Do you remember the army coming in during the strike?
During what?
The army coming in, or the National Guard, or anything like that?
Camp Lewis Army training camp. By the way, I spent less than 45 days in Camp Lewis. I was taken into the American Army.
Hmm.
Well, I was taken into the Army as a slacker, as a matter of fact. In Wyoming, I went for examination. I was not a citizen. Couldn't be. You had to live there 5 years before you could become a citizen. So I protested that I was not eligible for service. I had to be accepted because of being a Danish citizen. Well, it didn't mean anything. I was already called after we had left Casper, Wyoming, when we were traveling up in first in Yellowstone Park and then the actual Glacier National Park. Then when I landed in Seattle, I went to the room. And the second day, a couple of pictures were there. Because I had been called. And I was in a sitter. I didn't know what I had been called. But the minute he put it to me, then I, of course, then knew what was up. Well, this put me in New England. And then out to Fort Lawton. And there I was inducted into the Army. But I was out to Camp Lewis. And I was just on the eve of the armistice, November 11th. I think I was inducted a couple of days before, after the induction. But I got an honorable discharge, although it says AWOL for that period when I was called and didn't show up.
So you only in 45 days and then?
Less than 45 days, not in charge of any pension.
And but they didn't, were you then discharged because the war was over and they had no more need, or was it because you were left wing as a discharge?
Well, listen, look, I was anti-military in any case, naturally. And the minute I got out of the Army and I had an honorable discharge, well, I went back to Seattle and took up and kept back to my work, my regular activities. Mm-hmm. The flat was over.
Mm-hmm.
Through the meal right that the war came to an end.
Mm-hmm.
I would have hated to have to go to Europe.
Did you eat in any of the strikers' dining halls during the strike?
Hmm?
Did you eat in any of the dining halls that were during the strike?
Yeah.
I actually remember those pretty well.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Food prepared by cooks who knew how to prepare food. Good Russian food, not elaborate. No.
But it worked pretty smoothly.
Oh, everything went very, very smoothly. I remember we had an enormous hall at all the disposal for the feeders. So I went for my feeders. We had a number of feeding stations set up, quite a number. Not up in the rich areas, naturally. We let them take care of themselves.
Was the strike?
Oh, you asked the Army. An Army regiment was.
Oh, okay.
But the officers had enough sense to keep them discreetly in the background.
So they didn't
so
have
they never really, never really became conspicuous in the end. But you knew they were there.
Did that affect the strike in any way?
No.
Like they were there?
The strike went into regular course. No, we had the ones we had to confront more directly than police. And Ole Hansen had deputized 600 additional police and all armed with rifles. We knew that's what we had to contend with. And we also knew that we got to try not to give any excuse for politics,
mm-hmm.
for police intervention. That we knew. And we tried to avoid that. And the police, organized by the General Strike Committee, saw to that. That was their duty. To make sure that there were no demonstrations of the kind that the police could use as an excuse.
Was the General Strike worth it for labor?
Was it what?
Was it worth it? Was it
worth it? I told you it didn't attain the objective for the strike at Stuttgart, was it? In fact, their strike was really sold out in the end by their own international officials. But at the same time also, the shipbuilding industry was being dismantled at the same time. It had a tremendous spiritual effect.
A positive effect.
Very positive, in Seattle and throughout the country.
Then, did you feel that at the end of the strike, most workers felt proud of the general strike, or
yeah.
did they feel it had been a failure?
All felt proud of it. I remember here in L.A. once, NAM, if you know about NAM, by the way, I'm a member of NAM.
I have some greetings from other NAM comrades, I'll tell you later.
Then you got a good NAM chapter up in Santa
Barbara.
Very good one. I saw one of their documents. Good. I was asked to speak at one of their forums in this gathering on the strike. I did. And there were some ultra-leftists there also. One is known just exactly. Well, during the 5 days, how much did the worker consciousness advance? Well, I had to tell them, you know, it doesn't advance that fast. But it really became manifest in the conduct of the strike and also in what it meant to the worker after the strike and the effect throughout the country.
So you felt that the general strike did affect working people all over the country?
Was fully worldwide. Fully worldwide.
Mm-hmm. I know that it was a large issue in the Chicago Communist trial, Communist Labor Party, that Clarence Darrow defended a year or two later.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was after the Palmer Raids. The Palmer Raids came
right.
January 1920. But it rounded up all the aliens he could get hold of and deported a whole shipload of them. I was in Seattle. A strong labor movement probably never got into Seattle. Never.
That's very interesting.
And that speaks also well for the movement there. That's the reason he never wasn't in there. Otherwise, I would probably have been picked up tonight.
How about, though, that's interesting, federal government. Wasn't there, late 1919, there were a couple of prizes, weren't there? I mean, there was the attacks on the Socialist Party headquarters and on the Wobbly headquarters and the shutting down of the Union Record for a couple of days.
Both their way, the Socialist Party headquarters and IWW, and that was the time when the IWW got invited and brought to trial.
Mm-hmm. Was that a result of the general strike that they started those raids?
Oh,
and also
but it happened
rallies.
After the strike had come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
They were for blood, you know. Leading bourgeois, the ruling bourgeois, they were for blood. They wanted some victims that they could really punish. They got nowhere.
Did the general strike affect your life?
Yeah.
I mean, did it? Not just to those days, but did it have an effect on your life afterwards?
In the sense that a tremendous lesson I learned, for one thing. And then also in the sense, you know, that I became a member, founder of the Communist Party, something entirely new.
Could you tell me a little bit more about both of those? You said you learned a great lesson. I'd like to hear a little more about that. Was it also, what's the connection between your... But between the general strike and your becoming one of the founders of the Communist Party?
Well, becoming one of the founders, that was because I was a member of the left wing. And the split took place in Seattle. We did not engineer the left wing. The right wing did. In fact, we were expelled by the police.
Mm-hmm. Was there a connection between that, though, and the general strike in Seattle?
In the sense of we from four delegates from Seattle were definitely marked. And also in the sense, you know, that it had intensified the struggle in the Socialist Party.
The general strike had?
Oh, yes, it had an effect on that.
Could you tell me a little bit more about that and what way that...
Well, in the sense, you know, that the how it stimulates the left wing. Two great stimulants. More, the very greatest, of course, the Bolshevik Revolution, 1917, but also the general strike in Seattle. Also stimulates the left wing and the goals of the left wing and the consciousness of the left wing.
You say then that it was the second leading event in the United next to the Russian Revolution?
I would say that, yes. At that time it was. Because it is recognized even today as the first really officially recognized general strike on the American continent. Although during the upheavals of the 80s, there had been citywide strikes. One time, workers took over in St. Louis and won the city for a brief time. But the Seattle General Strike is recognized in history as the first, what they call bona fide general strike. That is really conducted by the labor movement, which was then the AFL. Nothing else for
the did people in the left wing think that there was much greater hope that was that used by people in the left wing and the Socialist Party to say, look, workers are on the move and we should be moving much farther?
That's exactly what it did. Mm-hmm. It helped to stimulate the idea for a new party, a party of a revolutionary party that really corresponded to the needs of the working class at the time.
Yeah. You also said that it affected your life and that you learned a great lesson.
Yeah, and it also affected my life insofar as my actual function and activity was concerned. You know, during that period, I was still a member of the Scandinavian Federation. That part of the Socialist Party. And the Scandinavian Federation published a paper, they published two papers, as they called it, one in Swedish, one in Danish Norwegian. And I had contributed stories about general strike and about developments in Seattle and that whole northwest area. So I was asked to come to return to Chicago and become editor of the paper.
And as a result of those stories?
Yeah. As a result of my activity there and what I had written into the paper and so forth.
So did you do that then?
1920. I returned to Chicago. Mm-hmm. Became editor. Then I was already a member of the Communist Party. It was after the Palmer Raids. It didn't take very long before I recognized and other comrades with me there in the Scandinavian Federation that a language, foreign language paper had really outlived its function because the Scandinavians were more quickly assimilated in the general American population and the working class. More quickly than, for example, the Slavic Federation, but took more slowly. The Scandinavians adapt themselves more easily, more quickly to this. So it was only, I was editor of that paper only for some weeks. Then they decided to transfer it into an English speaking paper. And they called it a New World. Well, a Catholic outfit contested the name, because they had that name for their paper, so they said New Age. And that became then transformed shortly after to the Voice of Labor, which was the unofficial spokesman for the underground Communist Party. The Communist Party was driven underground by the Palmer Raids. We had to function underground until the end of 1921, when we could finally organize the Workers' Party to come up and function legally. So, of course, when that Scandinavian paper, The New Age, was turned over to the Voice of Labor, well, my job ceased, although I collaborated, but my English was more deficient then than now, naturally. I got a new job. I was made the district organizer of the second largest district in the country, Chicago. Then the whole state of Illinois, the whole state. And the Calumet region of Indiana, the steel region, and the lower part of Wisconsin. Second most important district in the country.
Second to New York?
Second to New York is the largest. So I was made district organizer. I told the part of that I have not had that experience. Well, they honestly said, the experience that we had. Same thing. We all had to learn by doing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I remained at in that post up until the Lovestone Group finally took over the Communist Party completely.
That's a long time.
1927, and I was kicked out. But even then, after that, there was also, I think that's also the general part of the effect of my work and activity and experience in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big kingpins of the Communist Party leadership was a foreigner, John Pepper, who had, been one of the social democratic groups in Hungary who split away and united with the Béla Kun Communist Party in setting up the Soviet government in 1919. And it didn't last very long, it was overthrown. And then these leading elements fled to Moscow. And there they were, a group of immigrants, you know, in Moscow, in the pre-Hungarian Revolution. Didn't take very long before intense factional fights erupted in that small group, which is usually the case when you're kicked off of power and then have to exist in a different country. So the Communist International, to sort of try to break that up, decided to send Pepper to the United States. His name was Pogány. He came to the United States to work in the Hungarian Bureau. But you know, he was long training and much more experienced than we were through the fights in Europe, both externally and internally, factionally, what have you. And it didn't take very long before he was a spokesman in English, and he became elected a member of the Central Committee at the Underground Convention in Michigan, in Bridgman, in the woods of Michigan. I was not there. I was then already in Moscow. That's how I escaped that. Otherwise, that probably would have been picked up too. So I had a lot of luck in my life. Lots of luck. But I remained in mean, that post till 1927. 1925, I became a member of the Central Committee, the Communist Party.
How large was the Central Committee at that point?
It's quite large. I don't know if I can give you an exact number.
Oh, not an exact number?
More than 20.
Uh-huh. And how often did the Central Committee get together to...
It will get together only, let's say, with intervals maybe of a month or so. But it elected a political bureau, a political committee, that was then in charge in between.
Mm-hmm.
The Central Committee will be meeting plenums, you know, off and on.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say every other, every third month, something like that, depending on what the questions were or what issues were. Had to be tapped.
This is
But then I was going to mention a further changes of my life. Pepper finally, you know, we overcome the Pepper leadership in 1923. the Foster Cannon group, the major group, the Wissenberg Pepper Lobstrom group, a minority. Pepper was recalled to Moscow on our insistence. And in Moscow, he was assigned to go to Korea, which was then considered a graveyard for communist representatives. He now went to Korea, he came back to the United States and said, but he was a fugitive, that is, from the Communist International. But he had no sooner landed here than he proclaimed himself he was not going to be a faction fighter, nor he was going to be a moderator between the two factions. And he asked